This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Skyrocketing food costs, riots over prices, floods, and famines. The dark future, predicted by best-selling author Paul Harris in his important new book that I strongly encourage you to read. And we'll be giving away a copy here at the end of this interview. The book is The End of Food, best-selling author Paul Robert. Paul Roberts joins me on the long line. Paul, how are you? Good afternoon.
I'm good. It's good to be here. Thanks.
Absolutely. Welcome back to the program. We had talked last year, I think, about your previous book, The End of Oil, which, of course, was a runaway bestseller and one of those books that everybody was saying, you got to read this one. And now you've done it again. Here's another one that I tell you, it's just I knew so little about this. I'd read a couple of articles, but you take this whole subject, which can be complicated, and I guarantee you most people just aren't aware of this, and you put it all in one book. The End of Food, it sounds pretty bleak. So tell us, what are you arguing here? What is the point of the book?
Well, I guess there's two ways to answer that. I mean, the first is that, you know, when I started asking questions about the food business, you know, there's a lot of books about the politics of food. You know, there's we've had Fast Food Nation, a lot of finger pointing books about nutrition, but there wasn't really a book about the business of food. And I realized that so much of what's happening today, whether we're talking about high food prices, you know, safety scares, we got tomatoes, is it chilies? We don't know. We got contaminated imports from China. So many of those news items that we're reading about the food system all derive from the food business. It's decisions that companies and investors are making, and it's business models they're using, and this is what we're left with. And yet there was nothing out there for the, you know, kind of the regular Joe on the street. And what I wanted was a user's guide, and that's what I've tried to write. So when we, you know, when we look at what's the headlines today, we say, well, what's going on here? You know, you can say, well, we've got biofuels are sucking up grains, and we've got pathogens getting into the meat supply. But is there something central going on? And I think there is. I think we've got a food system that has done a great job for a couple hundred years. You know, basically we said, give us the most food you can for the least cost, and it's done it. And the good news is we've been able to make a lot of food and feed a lot of people. The bad news is we've reached a point now where crushing costs, pushing down costs lower and lower, is finally biting us. We're finally seeing the downside of food that's too cheap.
We're talking with best-selling author Paul Roberts. The new book is The End of Food. So your book really, if to boil it down, is about the making, the marketing, and the moving of what we eat. And we have seen, you know, as you point out, over the last couple hundred years, sort of a production and distribution system that was created. But now that system can't really, it's failing. It can't really serve the billions of people now that have to eat.
That's right, and it's failing in some ways that are, some of them are fairly familiar and make a lot of sense, and some are a little less intuitive, and you have to dig a bit. But let's look at, you know, you need things to make food. We call them inputs, and the cost of inputs is going up. So you look at oil. You know, this is a food system. The modern food system that we're using today, that you and I depend on, was really built during the 60s and 70s. And, you know, that's when a lot of the systems that we use today really came into being. And you got to remember that oil was pretty darn cheap back then. We had a few price spikes, but the average price of oil was dirt cheap, less than $10 a barrel. Now we're looking at oil that's, you know, well over $100 a barrel, and it's very likely going to stay there for a while. And you're asking yourself, now, how does the system designed for cheap oil, how long can we keep running that on expensive oil?
Right, right.
You know, and then you look at the other inputs. I mean, fertilizers. You know, people forget that the ability to manufacture fertilizer cheaply and at large scale, that has been key to our ability to produce a lot of food. Today, this is a figure that blows people away. 40% of the calories that we produce worldwide is directly responsible, or is rather directly attributable to our ability to produce cheap synthetic nitrogen fertilizers. Now, the good news is that that's, again, allowed us to create a lot of calories. The bad news is, where do we get nitrogen fertilizer? We get it from natural gas. Natural gas is a cousin of oil. That means it's getting scarcer and more expensive. And that's one reason in the last 12 months, we've seen fertilizer costs triple. Now, if you keep in mind that nearly half the calories we grow come from these fertilizers, And you keep in mind also that the price of those fertilizers is tripling. And then someone tells you, well, and you know, over the next 40 years, we're going to add another 4 billion people to our population. And those people are not just going to be eating, but they're going to be eating more meat, which takes a lot more grain. You start wondering, how does this system all work? How does that equation all equal out?
It's chilling to think about.
Well, and it should be. I mean, you know, I'm sure you've read about these crises in the past. Humanity is continually running up against a wall when it comes to feeding itself. You go back 100 years, you go back 1,000 years, we were always running into new constraints. We'd outgrow a particular region, and we'd have to move, find some new land, or we'd have to find some new technology. But the point was, we always figured it out. During the, let's say, the 18th and 19th centuries, Europe was just on its knees. There were more people than they could feed adequately, and a huge fraction of the population, as much as 40%, existed in a kind of a nutritional purgatory. They were so underfed and so sick from being underfed that they basically could walk a few hours a day, so they absolutely couldn't work. Europe was close to a cataclysmic famine, and what saved it? Well, two things. First, they opened up a lot of farmland in the New World and began shipping food back to Europe, but they also developed ways to grow more food per acre. And there's a lot of technologies, fertilizers, better seeds, mechanization. They started inventing tractors. And that gave them a huge burst of productivity, and they defeated the crisis. They essentially pushed it back. And, you know, we had that happen again in the 1960s. We saw India and Bangladesh on the verge of cataclysmic famine, booming populations, declining production. What saved them? Well, a green revolution. And again, it was technologies that allowed us to grow more food, better fertilizers, better seeds, and irrigation. Now, why can't we just do that again? What's going to stop us again? And I say that, you know, clearly we're going to have new technologies that are coming. Already we've got new technologies coming online. But we're also facing some new constraints that our predecessors didn't have to deal with. We talked a little bit about oil and how that's more expensive and fertilizer, but water. You know, so much of the past agricultural revolutions, the big booms and the green revolution, were built on irrigation water, the ability to pump water out of the ground and get it into fields that had previously been dry. And lo and behold, you could grow crops there. Well, it turns out that in many parts of the world, that heavy irrigation came at a great cost. It essentially sucked the water out of the ground so fast that many of these underground aquifers haven't been able to recharge. So you've got places in India, places in China, places in North Africa, where the water tables are actually falling, and farmers are having to drill more deeper every year to reach water. And they estimate that a sixth of the populations of India and China, so we're talking a lot of people, we're talking 400 million people, are being fed with irrigation that is unsustainable. That is irrigation that's overdrawing these aquifers. So you begin adding all this stuff, and you throw in climate, which is going to change how much we can produce. And again, the question is, where are we going to get all the food to feed these people?
We're talking with best-selling author Paul Roberts. The new book is The End of Food, and we'll be giving away a free copy here in just a few minutes. Keep listening if you're interested. And, of course, the phone lines are open at 977-1070 if you have a question. So, Paul, what kind of time frame are we talking about? And I want folks to understand that you're not a Chicken Little here saying, oh, my gosh, but this is a very, very serious, chilling thing that if you take the time like yourself to go around the world and do this research and this investigation, what you learn is not encouraging. I mean, it truly is. If we keep doing what we're doing as far as the making and the moving of food, we're going to be in a lot of trouble and a lot of people are going to starve if we don't change something.
Right. And I think that, you know, you can already see pressure. You know, certainly we've seen high food prices, and of course people are trying to figure out, now why is it? Well, what's driving that? And I divide that into two categories. There's near-term drivers and there's long-term. In the near-term, we've had, you know, some bad weather that's hurt a lot of harvest. We've also had a big biofuels initiative both in North America and in Europe and in Asia, converting a lot of grain acreage into fuel acreage. And that's pinched supplies a lot more than I think we anticipated. You know, and it's very controversial and very political. In the United States, for example, the U.S. really doesn't have another alternative energy policy. We don't really have a way to take pressure off of high oil prices other than biofuels. So it's very tough politically for Congress to stop subsidizing biofuels because it's like telling voters, well, sorry, you're just going to have to deal with high oil prices. That said, I think we're going to eventually see enough pressure on Congress where we're going to lose some of that subsidy that's now allowing people to refine take corn into ethanol.
Right.
Now, what's critical to keep in mind here, though, is that although biofuels are contributing to the price spike today, they are a temporary issue. In other words, they're political. And just as, but you know, in the same way that Congress provided that subsidy, Congress could take it away. You can't say the same thing about some of these longer-term drivers that are pushing up food prices. Now, we talked a little bit about population, how that's growing. But what's key to remember about population is that many of these newcomers are, in a sense, catching up. They're in the developing world, and they're catching up with Western dietary standards. And by that, I mean mainly meat eating. You know, in Asia, traditionally, it's been a pretty vegetarian society. We've always imagined that it was philosophically driven toward vegetarianism, that their various religions and philosophies were conducive to eating less meat. Well, it turns out that what was really driving that was economics. They were too poor to afford meat. Now they're getting wealthy. Now they're buying meat. And the thing about meat is it takes a lot of grain. You need, on average, 8 pounds of grain to make a pound of meat. So what you see happening is
that... Say that again. You need 8 pounds of grain to make a pound of meat.
A single pound of meat. And that's the average. Chicken, of course, is very efficient, so you need less grain to make a pound of chicken. But beef is really inefficient. You need 20 pounds of grain to make a pound of meat. So next time you eat a steak, keep in mind what's going on there. And, of course, you know, 20 pounds of grain represents, depending on where you're growing it, about 20,000 pounds of water. It takes a lot of these resources to grow the grain, which is then condensed into meat. So, you know, one of the reasons we've been able to enjoy meat so freely in this country is because grain has been so cheap. And now that grain is becoming more expensive, we're beginning to ask, okay, how much longer can we, as the United States, eat this much? Well, the rest of the world is just catching up to that. And so if you imagine a world that's much more carnivorous, you know, if you imagine Asian meat intake doubling, even though they'd be far from our standard, just the fact that there's 1.2 billion Chinese doubling their meat intake, it changes the world. And it geometrically increases the amount of grain we need.
Yeah, not to mention the water.
The water, yeah. every input. You can see a lot of these countries getting around this by importing water in the form of grain. So China now has got a lot of water problems. It essentially has begun importing soybeans and has since the 90s from places like Argentina and Brazil. And it's effectively importing Brazil's water.
Wow, amazing. Best-selling author Paul Roberts, the book is The End of Food, about the coming food crisis. Fascinating book. So, Paul, what is the solution and or solutions that we should be exploring, whether, you know, in the political field or not?
Well, I guess there's a couple different ways to answer that. Right now, people are throwing out solutions as quickly as they can. I mean, they're tossing them out and saying, here, let's do this. So you hear, let's do organic, let's do local, let's do free range, let's eat less meat, let's eat no meat. And on the upside is that people are now thinking about alternatives. The downside is a lot of these alternatives aren't by themselves going to work. Organic is challenged. If we were to, say, fertilize with manure, see, organic means you can't use synthetic fertilizer. So if we were going to fertilize with manure, or if we were going to fertilize the soil by using cover crops, and that's essentially where you rotate your cash crop with a crop that replenishes the soil.
Right, right.
You either need a lot of cows to produce that manure, and the cows, of course, require grain, or you need to take a lot of your corn fields out of production to grow these cover crops. In either case, you've reduced your output. So organic itself isn't the whole answer. People point to genetic modification. They say, well, this is what we'll do. You know, we'll actually tinker at the molecular level and make these crops generate, you know, bigger yields. And it's a great idea, and in theory it works, but... companies have had a real hard time. Companies like Monsanto and Syngenta have had a really hard time actually boosting yield. What they can do pretty successfully is tinker on the single, change a single trait, like make a soybean that will actually survive when you spray it with a pesticide so that you can just hose the whole field down with pesticide, kill the weeds, but not kill the soybeans. That works, but there's only a single trait involved there. Yield takes thousands of traits. So we may eventually get there, but even Monsanto, which is a big proponent of GM, thinks it's going to be a 20 to 25 year path to get there, and we need solutions today. So the easy ones aren't there. I think what we're going to need to start with is basically from scratch and ask, you know, what is it that we can do at what level? So the level of government, and by this I mean taxpayers, we're going to need to start funding pretty substantially alternative agriculture. That is, ways to grow food that take less energy, take less fertilizer, and less water. We know how to do that on a small scale. Now we need to really roll that out in a big way. And like it or not, that is something that government's going to have to get behind because it's going to take a lot of research money.
Paul, should we be encouraged? I'm thinking back in World War II when people had freedom gardens and they were encouraged to invest the time and the money and the energy into growing their own foods in their yards. Is that where we're going?
I think World War II is a really good model because you had both the government-led initiatives, like we had to develop weapon systems. That's something that consumers can't do, so the government takes that over. Government builds the ships, et cetera. But on the consumer level, what is it that consumers can do? And, you know, we can't all go back to being farmers. Some of us have the ability and the land to have a garden. I think we should do that just because gardening is good for you. I mean, making food is good for you, but making things generally is good for you, too. We're a nation of consumers, and I think we need to move back to being a nation of producers. I think that we need to start educating ourselves about our food supply. Again, you know, my approach was to study and understand the business of food, and I think that consumers could do a lot in that regard. Just understanding, you know, when they walk into a grocery store, what's the business story behind all these products? Why are they there? They're not there just by accident. They're there because they made sense in an economic way, and that economic model is changing. So that's something to do, education. I think the last thing is, and this is the Martha Stewart moment, and I'm sorry, but you got to start cooking. You know, we used to cook, everyone used to cook many times a night, and think about what cooking does. It allows you to control the quality and the quantity of the food that comes into the household. You're taking raw ingredients, you're transforming them into meals, you're planning menus, you're stocking a pantry. I know that sounds pretty boring, but it requires you to think about your food, and we have stopped thinking about food. We have essentially outsourced the function of food. Food is like the most critical thing. It's more important than sex. And yet we have outsourced that function to an industry that is struggling now to sustain itself. And I don't think that's a very safe position. So taking back that function is step one. People tell you, hey, look, I don't have time to do that. You know, the average household has less than a half an hour a day to devote to cooking. And I say, okay, that's fine. I know you're busy. I know you got a job or two, if you're lucky. You got kids, you got errands. But, you know, the average American that claims he only has a half an hour to cook also is somehow managing to find 4.5 hours to watch TV every day. So I think if we're going to give food the priority it deserves, you know, we need to shift that around. And people will tell you, hey, I watch a lot of cooking shows. Well, it's time to stop watching other people cook food.
And we can invest in, Charlottesville here has a terrific farmers market. We're seeing them pop up in communities throughout Central Virginia. We have places like in the Valley, Shenandoah Valley. We've got Polyface Farms, which is a free-range organic place where you can go over and sort of be one of those investors and get part of a cow
those are exactly the things. You can't do the whole thing overnight, but it's incremental. And you know, it's really interesting as transportation costs. It used to cost about $2,500 to take a truckload of produce from the Salinas Valley in California to New York. It now costs about $9,000. That's a huge increase in price. And what that's forcing these big these retailers to do is to start sourcing locally. They don't want to, you know, they're not going to advertise it necessarily, but it's a business decision. They're starting to look around and saying, where does it make sense to source locally? They haven't had, you know, because these local farmers never were competitive with the big farmers in California. Now suddenly they are. And that's a sea change. And I think you're seeing people take the initiative sort of actively, and you're also seeing supply and demand sort of forcing change. So the next 5 years are going to be a real exciting time.
Paul Roberts, best-selling author. The new book is The End of Food. Paul, I always look forward to talking to you. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. It's a terrific book, and it's one everyone should read.
All right. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SevillePodcast.com for more.